This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is poet Hayes Davis with a premier book of poems. And what is this book about?
This book is about family in a lot of ways. It's about my father. It's about being a son. It's about being a father. It's about relationships with my wife, with my children, with my siblings.
Son, father, teacher, Hayes Davis, give us a poem.
Thank you. Route 1 North, Philadelphia to Highland Park. Your father has given you the wheel. The mostly empty highway offers your 17-year-old road eyes no distractions, and the Firebird descending the on-ramp is red. The left turn signal isn't instinctive yet, nor is the glance that checks your blind spot before the lane change. But as you settle back into the forward focus of highway driving, your father's hand covers your gear shift perched right, his mouth curling before opening, "Good job." He doesn't remind you that sharing the road with newcomers is less instinctual for you than your blind spot check. He is all praise. And when the therapist asks 10 years later what you miss, how you imagined him feeling when you pictured handing over the grandchild he will never know, you remember that he never held praise too tightly, that he knew confidence as a vested commodity, its installation as vital as anything fathers give sons.
He never held praise too tightly. What a way to talk about generosity. Hayes Davis is here. He is a graduate of the University of Maryland and is an award winner. He won an Academy of American Poets Prize, and he's a member of Cave Canem's first group of fellows, former Breadloaf Working Scholar and a former Geraldine Miles Poet Scholar at Squaw Valley. We're very happy to have you. I talked about your book as having hard subjects, but the poems were not hard. Do you know what I mean by that?
What I try to bring to my work is a vulnerability, being open to a different conception of masculinity. That's what I saw from my father. That's what I've seen from most of the men in my family. I think that there is often in our society a toxic kind of definition of manhood.
Oh, that is an excellent answer.
That you can't cry, that you can't show emotion, that you can't, that you've got to be confrontational, violently confrontational, controlling, et cetera. And I try not to be that.
Thank you. And your poems achieve that. And there are some desperate situations and some hard and tender times. So in writing about those that can be raw, what do you overcome in yourself to be able to do that?
I think there's an emotional distance that's necessary before you can really write well about something. Writing can be therapeutic. Writing well involves craft. It involves being able to step back and understand what the poem needs if it's going to be a good poem, that you've got to create imagery, that you've got to ground the poem in sensory things. And I'm still working on this. I don't think all of the poems in the book necessarily achieve that.
Does time help? Did you have to wait a number of years before you could tell certain stories?
Yes. And in fact, there's a poem that is about the way that time helps with grief.
Give us two poems in a row so
Sure.
we get a real healthy sense of Hayes Davis at the Library of Congress.
Vessel. The beach as I had never seen it. November. Wind that wasn't breeze. Sun that wasn't warm. Surf that held the odd smile of scattering his ashes in the place he loved. The sky stretched in cliché. I hugged the urn. We stood in a circle. A radio played Hymn to Freedom. I didn't want to let go. Didn't want to let go. My brothers and I carried him to the water. So many ashes, a pile on the wet sand. The surf came, swept. We walked back up the beach. I turned, watched until the surf took everything. Dust, chips, fragments took my father out to sea. Repair. Spring. Abundant rain. Recovering lawn strengthened by two fertilizer treatments. Hedges boast verdure, annuals flourish, pastel hues nudge away memories of last summer's drought. My father loved azaleas, but now when they return, fuchsia slicked with days of steady downpour, I don't linger in front of his paintings, search for pictures of him standing. I smile at the color of the bushes, consider the rich late evening light, the backyard dappled with sun, the scent of ginger marinated chicken on the grill. When a thud escapes the bedroom window, I know the fragile body sculpture I just rehung has fallen. But I don't rush inside, upstairs, fighting tears. I turn the chicken, ask confirmation through the window screen, think Strohsnyder's, wood glue, replacement nails. I use his hammer to rebuild the frame, return the piece to the wall, but it escapes me that it's Father's Day. 8 years has dulled the sharp edge of empty.
I think the one thing we can say about your poetry is that you can taste, feel, and smell it.
Thank you.
The best thing I could say about anything. Why send a poem out deaf, dumb, and blind? Really. Yours are rich with sensory perceptions, as you mentioned. Hayes, we would like to hear another poem.
Okay.
And the title of the book is?
Let Our Eyes Linger.
And why?
It's in one of the poems, and Dan Vetta, one of the poets who helped me bring this into the world, was reading through. He did the layout. He did the design of the book, and there's a poem that has that line in it. And he one day sent me the cover image with the title. We went through, I think, 5 or 6 titles before we settled on this one. And when he sent it to me, it just felt absolutely perfect. My father's artwork appears on the cover. And so I felt like, let our eyes linger on that. Let our eyes linger on the life that I try to convey in the poem. Let our eyes linger. Also, to me, speaks to one of the truths about poetry, I believe, is that poetry has the wonderful ability to slow the world down. That you can take a moment and you can just linger on it and you can write about it and write about it and write about it and just break it down into all of its elemental parts.
That's a good way to think of linger. I have always thought that poetry was like dreaming and you can't dream in a hurry, but the word linger is perfect. So read us that poem.
Sure.
That applies.
Redefined. Years ago, the paddle boat would have been a rowboat. My t-shirt, long sleeves, and a tie. Blazer, straw low topper. You assuredly not in jeans, but a white dress over petticoats, chemise, corset, gloves, of course, a jaconet and parasol to deflect the sun. It would still be Sunday, but a chaperone might have watched from the hill instead of groundhogs. The old Lyme, Connecticut retreat house and estate, with gardeners, servants the same color as us and the other poets who now share the space. I'd have read Keats or Browning out loud, balancing gravitas and romantic flourishes. We'd be courting, not married, for what know the married, so it's said, of moments that stir our eros. Why should we imagine ourselves more than betrothed and attracted to each other, still stirred by the feeling of palm on nape of neck? Dare we circle this pond without argument over chores and money? Dare we let our eyes linger on lips, the smooth skin between neck and collarbone, as we speak of metaphor, recite modern poems with or without ulterior motive? Dare we believe this time well spent?
Hayes Davis at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. His poetry has been published in many prestigious literary journals, New England Review, Poet Lore, Gargoyle, Beltway, Poetry Quarterly, Delaware Poetry Review, Kinfolks, Fledgling Rag, and others. He teaches high school in Washington, D.C., and he's married to the poet Terry Ellen Cross Davis. She
yes.
has 4 names. So another piece from this book.
Sure. So The last poem I read was about before kids. That was 2 years before our daughter was born. This one is about after kids. And I'm going to set it up a little bit. Parenting is sacrifice. And as an only child of my mom and dad getting together, I've struggled with that sacrifice. So this is about finding a place or finding ways in which to, as the title says, make it work for you. When I ask my daughter if she wants tacos, I get to eat one of my favorite dishes. When I buy organic fruit strips for Zoe and her infant brother, I get half of his. We parents talk freely about bedtimes, potty training, daycare situations, schools, but I've never heard, "Hey, I hustled my daughter to read the book I wanted to last night." The promise of ice cream after lunch unfurrows the asparagus-affected brow, guarantees the dulce de leche you've craved. Raise your voice half an octave, and bath time sounds exciting, brings bedtime closer. A trip to Target after they are both asleep is alone time. I blast the radio or call my mother, my West Coast brother. Often I'm happy for the silence, so I take it, each time with less guilt. I take it.
I had been thinking about the fact that in every poet's poem, there is a struggle. And some of it is more nuanced than others. There's clearly struggles in that poem.
Mm-hmm.
But also, in each of your poems, there is acceptance. There is some acceptance of the situation. Are you aware of that?
Yes, because I have accepted and leaned into and cherished fatherhood, which is not something, I think there are more fathers at the park with their kids nowadays than there were even 20 years ago, 30 years ago, definitely 40 years ago.
Even about fatherhood, in poems that weren't even about fatherhood, you reach an arc and then there is some sort of amelioration mm-hmm. in your poetry. I was wondering if you were aware of that.
Maybe it's the Libra in me that seeks balance. Maybe it's the I'm biracial, and so I don't know. In ways, I've always found myself sometimes in the middle, looking at two sides.
Oh, that's so interesting.
In the middle, looking at two different people having an interaction and understanding where both of them are coming from, and understanding where they're not hearing each other.
Well, that would be perfect for your teaching.
Yes.
Perfect for your teaching.
It has
Were you
helped.
Ever
it
considering has anything else but teaching?
I went to college thinking I was going to be a physical therapist. I was pre-physical therapy for 2 years, freshman year, sophomore year. Sophomore year, spring break, I was taking five classes, but the two I remember are reading poetry with David Walton at the University of Pittsburgh, and statistics, and I don't remember the professor's name. And I was getting an A in the reading poetry class, and I was failing statistics.
And so weren't we all.
While we're talking about Pittsburgh, I have to give credit to Toy Derricotte, one of the people who did a blurb for the book and who has just been my poetry mother. I mean, as
she
just
began
took me under
Cave
her wing.
Canem.
She did.
She's our goddess.
Yes, absolutely.
Toy is our goddess.
Absolutely.
And is that where she's teaching still?
She has retired from the University of Pittsburgh.
Oh, that's...
She still lives in Pittsburgh. Terrence Hayes is now running the creative writing program, English department there. And Yona Harvey's there. Dawn Lundy Martin, so Kaveh Kahneman is sort of
it rocks.
taking over the Pitt
it rocks.
The Pitt Poetry Program.
Pittsburgh rocks. This is Hayes Davis, and we're at the Library of Congress on The Poet and the Poem. Did you have any new poems that you wanted to share?
Absolutely.
And then we can go back to the book so people can remember the name and they can order it.
I have stuttered since I started talking, and I went to a program about 12 years ago called the Precision Fluency Shaping Program. But long before that, I took French in seventh grade, and the French word for stutter is bégaiement. In seventh grade French class, Mrs. Smythe encouraged us to lever la main, a phrase I only understood years later because I never raised my hand, never volunteered to further complicate my stutter with translation and accent, When we recited as a class, my voice joined my classmates, freed from the individual struggle of clenching throat and short breath. But when we opened our workbook, took sequential turns reading aloud, my muscles tightened. When recitation's path neared my desk, I predicted which words would freeze just behind my teeth, remembered every other time 20-some pairs of eyes stared while I worked to force the words from page to brain to mouth and out. When the clock didn't offer the escape of ending class before my turn to read, sometimes I wondered if this might be the time it worked for me. If seconds wouldn't feel like minutes, if my shoulders wouldn't hunch, if my cheeks wouldn't flush, if my armpits wouldn't moisten, if my eyes wouldn't dart left and right to see who was watching, if I wouldn't wish for even a snicker to break the silence or the monotony.
That is unbelievable. That is unbelievable. You're like a piece of silk when you talk.
Thank you.
Really. Actually, there are poems like that in the book.
Yes.
And that's what I thought had to do with courage. When I teach writing, I tell the students we're really teaching courage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's have another piece of courage.
Thank you. And I left, there's an ending couplet to that last poem that I left off. Sorry about that. To break the silence or the monotony of a single syllable issuing again and again like some sort of Sisyphean sentence.
Say that couplet again.
Sure.
It exists in its own right.
Of a single syllable issuing again and again like some sort of Sisyphean sentence.
It's almost an aphorism all by itself. Hayes Davis is here with his new book.
This is Etiquette. I am 8, sitting at my grandmother's kitchen table, trying to ask to be excused. My cousins Jennifer and Danielle watch my open mouth, keep sounding out, "Can I be excused?" like I don't understand what I'm supposed to say. They don't know that "can" is a word I sometimes can't say, like hello when I answer the phone, good night when my dad leaves the room, my name when people ask it. They don't know that when my teacher's eyes search the class for an answer, even if I know it, I look down. They don't know that my consonants fly away sometimes, like birds when it gets too cold. I stare back at Danielle's mouth, Jennifer's mouth, Oma's mouth, trying to figure out what makes talking so easy for them. Maybe my stutter will go away when I get older. People on the bus, at the supermarket, in the candy store, always tell me about their cousins and sisters and brothers older than me who once stuttered like me. They've outgrown theirs, and I hope mine will disappear one day too, so I won't miss so many cartoons after lunch.
Oh, boy. That's a powerful poem. How were you changed after writing your poetry?
I had a voice. I have a student this year who stutters, and she's a very, very good writer. And I think that there's something, for some stutterers, about getting our voice on the page with precision. And so with poetry, I could shape the words the way I wanted to on the page. I could pick line breaks. I could pick stanza breaks. Terry often says that there's a precision to my poetry.
I remarked upon that after first reading it. That is true. How do you think each book of poetry changes the landscape of all poetry, though?
It's another, we're about to be in fall, it's another color among all the leaves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are echoes of previous poets, whether you mean them or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's another voice. It's another, you know, no two poems are exactly alike. So it's this ever-expanding world of words that tries to capture. Gwendolyn Brooks once said, poetry is life distilled. So it's the continuing distillation of life. It's the development of language. It's the development of voices, generation after generation.
And amazingly so, because there are tons of poems being written every day.
Mm-hmm.
But as you point out, everyone is inimitable and everyone adds something. And that is kind of a miracle to me. That's why I love the field so much.
Yeah.
But give us more of the field.
Absolutely. Presence. Dirt on the boots we wore to dig the hole. Hairs collected in the vacuum a month ago. Pet store receipt for diapers. Unstolen food on the dining room table. Unclaimed food under the dining room table. Loose hair in broom bristles. The quiet delivery of mail. Oatmeal shampoo on the shelf in the laundry room. Lamb and chicken blend in the pantry. The chewed up tennis ball under the couch. The chewed up tennis ball behind the bookcase. The chewed up tennis ball in the coat closet. The chewed up tennis ball in the toy box. Hairballs in places we haven't dusted yet. Sympathy card from the vet's office. Walking downstairs alone at 5:30 a.m.
Once I asked you how you stand in the middle of the poem and create the world, the outer world. But I think by hearing that, I know the answer. You make objects resonate. You get the vibration from things. I don't believe you use your nighttime mind. Do you use your dream state very much?
Not in my poetry, no. I don't. It's funny, unless I dream, you know that really great REM sleep that you get? If you don't have to wake up at 6 a.m., say you can sleep until 8, that's when I'll remember my dreams. So I don't often remember them because I get up very early for school. And I don't know that I've written one dream poem. It's in the book, Chinese Takeout Dream.
Let's hear it.
Turning from our small talk to the man behind the counter, your eyes dart across the board, settle on Szechuan shrimp wrapped in tortillas with chestnuts and almonds. As your lips form Szechuan, the ambient hum of Saturday night hustle stops, looks at you, hangs on every word that floats on pastel blue clouds from your lips to the man's hand holding the Bic pen that waits to trail ink across the order pad. The pen almost forgets how to write because it's trying to remember the last time it saw clouds and words like yours. The hand holding the pen almost forgets how to move for the same reason. The Bic remembers the platinum-plated fountain pen from the nice part of town, her smooth ink. The hand remembers the rainy day when its owner got asked out by a French manicurist. The hand and pen smile, push across the order sheet. You turn back to me, ask what I'm doing later, and the sun comes out from behind the jukebox.
Now give us another new poem.
Sure,
as
sure.
As we round the bend.
Absolutely.
And then we will want a final poem.
Okay. This is
a premiere, right?
Yes, this is a premiere. At 13, my sister stands before me, the bust of her Sunday best engorged. My infant nephew Max begs her hastened farewell. Cars pass behind me. The 34 trolley, recently emerged from the tunnel, glides up Baltimore Avenue, but my attention is riveted. Not by her breasts as sexual, but by drops of milk soaking fabric, beginning to drip to the ground. She follows my eyes, Max squirming in her left arm, instinct dictating his reach, and it will be years before I comprehend this moment's meaning. What I have just glimpsed firsthand, the indescribable bond between boy and mother. For now, I am teenage boy. Her breasts are eye level. Her embarrassment palpable in her quick steps to the car.
Now, there's another one where it took time to surface, but it was there in your data bank.
It was there. It was there. I was reading Celeste Doak's, her first book, Cornrows and Cornfields. She lives in Baltimore, wonderful poet, and she has a lot in that first book about adolescence. And so that took me back, and I started writing. So there was that poem. There was the poem about seventh grade French class. Going to be in this second collection. I'm trying to get away from myself. And there's a series of poems in the first collection in The Voice of Jim. And I want to explore some famous folks who stuttered in this second book. along with adolescence.
We are waiting. Now give us a final poem.
Absolutely. This is in the voice of Jim, the runaway slave from Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Famous book, famous moment in the book when Huck tries to make Jim believe that something Jim knows has happened is not real. And I've taught the book ever since I started teaching. And about 4 years into it, I thought to myself, we only ever hear about Jim from Huck's point of view. And Huck's 14, and he lives in the antebellum South, and he's been raised with all of the propaganda that surrounded slavery. And so his perception of Jim is colored, pun intended, I guess, by that. And so I tried to capture Jim's voice. And so this is Jim in this moment, making some calculations about how he's going to react. Jim on the raft after his dream. The snake in my bed on Jackson's Island wasn't trick enough. Now Huck tell me I dreamt the fog, his canoe cut loose from the raft. Say I dreamt 2 hours searching for the only white person who might not turn me in. He ask if I been drinking, look me in the eye and say he been here all along. This got to stop if we gonna make it down river, make it to Cairo and the free states, but I play along for now. Looky here, boss, they something wrong. I give him one more chance, boy only 14, far from home, friends, whoever he call family. I tell him what we both know, the fog, us whooping, trying to find each other, mixed up among the towheads and islands, raft almost grounded, me almost drowning. But he dig in harder than a rat chasing pup, call it a staving dream, ask me tell him about it. Sunrise pushing night out the sky, birds singing, he study my face while I interpret the dream. Painting everything up as warnings, saying we'd be okay if we mind our business, stay off land for now. While he watching me, I'm trying to decide how much daddy talk he might take from a nigger. When I finish, he ask what the mess on the raft stand for, and my voice bites sharper than I thought it ever would around any white person, even a boy. His eyes bug out. He stare at me. Then he set his jaw, walk off, stay on the far corner of the raft for 15 minutes. When he come back slow, mouth quivering, apologizing, I let my breath out. Later he asked why I didn't beat a tin pan in the fog, keep beating it till we found each other. He get real quiet when I ask how many runaways he know want attention.
Oh, Hayes, what a contribution.
Thank you.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Bitter Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation. Additional support by Friend of Poetry, Hiram LaRue. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.